be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Pierre has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Board of Insight's Teen Parent Program, a Portland program that helps teens cope with parenthood, is hosting a benefit this weekend.
Investigative reporter Jason Leopold analyzes parallels between Watergate and leaks of classified information under the current administration.
According to a new report, biodiesel is now cheaper than gasoline.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,406 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 38,861 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. In 2004, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 3rd, 2006. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi. Republican Kevin Mannix bragged during an interview yesterday on a Christian radio station that he had won an exclusive endorsement from the state's major anti-abortion group, Oregon Right to Life. Even when he was a Democrat years ago, Mannix said on Portland's KPDQ, I was clearly pro-life, unabashedly pro-life, end quote. For the second governor's race in a row, Mannix hopes abortion will play a major role in bringing him the Republican nomination, just as it did in 2002 when he beat two more well-funded opponents who favored abortion's rights. The Mannix campaign has directed radio commercials and mailings to voters opposed to abortion. This week, his campaign is making thousands of automated calls to voters using the recorded voice of Gail Atterbury, Right to Life's executive director. Mannix's chief rival, Ron Saxton, was heavily outspent Mannix on the airwaves and has worked to blur his differences with Mannix on abortion. Saxton continues to describe himself as pro-choice, but he has courted Right to Life and other anti-abortion groups by saying he would support at least three of their abortion restrictions. Many moderate Republicans say the party's anti-abortion tilt has hurt in a state regarded as one of the most supportive of abortion rights in the country.
Former Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber will be the keynote speaker at the university's third annual Oregon Economic Forum, which will be held at the Oregon Zoo in Portland on October 11th. The forum brings together professionals from the public and private sectors in order to share economic ideas. Many faculty members in Oregon's economics departments work on issues such as health care, equality matters, and macroeconomics. The forum provides an environment to share their work with the public and other professionals. This year's topic will be the growing problem of funding health care. Kitzhaber, also a physician, tried to reform Oregon's Medicaid program in the early 1990s. Kitzhaber was selected because he has been an aggressive proponent for change in Oregon's health care system. The forum will begin at 7:30 a.m., and the cost is $50.
With the new surge in gas prices, it is now officially cheaper to fill up your gas tank with biodiesel. KBOO's Spencer Raymond reports.
Biodiesel has been around for a few years, but it has only been recently when the demand has really picked up. Biodiesel is made of vegetable oil and can be used in most diesel vehicles with little or no modifications. In Portland, one company has been on the forefront of the biodiesel market. Sequential Biofuels has biodiesel stations up and down the I-5 corridor. Biodiesel can be sold for cheaper because it is sold in a different market. Tyson Kiever of Sequential Biofuels in Portland says the price has held steady because of supply and demand.
We've been at the same pump price for probably the last 6 months now, whereas we see petroleum diesel fluctuate even hourly. With the price of diesel continuing to climb right now, we're seeing diesel rack prices over $2.50 a gallon. It's making biodiesel more and more competitive cost-wise.
Biodiesel was selling for up to 30 cents more per gallon than regular diesel as recently as a few months ago, but as petroleum diesel prices have risen lately, the price of biodiesel has held steady and demand has skyrocketed.
For the past 3 years, we've seen a pretty steady increase. The traditional barriers to entry or for people being willing to try biodiesel are price, availability, and awareness. And as price goes away being the largest concern, We have tractor trailers and large trucking companies and municipalities and anyone that initially had that concern knocking on the door.
Besides environmental benefits, buyers of biodiesel can join co-ops and get special prices for their fuel. Kiever said this is a great way for people to save money, especially if they know they will use biofuel exclusively.
The idea behind a buying group is you get a bunch of people together that know they want to buy this fuel, they can use the fuel, you get some infrastructure set up, and they go in and they purchase a bulk order and get that bulk discount, and they then, in turn, don't mark up the price to cover the labor of a retail station.
Sequential Biofuel has several locations in the Portland area. For a complete list, log on to their website at www.sqbiofuels.com. I'm Spencer Raymond, KBU News.
Uninsured Americans are sicker and die younger than people with health insurance, according to a new report released for Cover the Uninsured Week, and Oregon is among the nation's highest in uninsured residents. KBU's Sheila Whiteside reports.
About one of every six Oregonians doesn't have health insurance. That's almost twice the national average, according to a report from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The importance of getting those people care is the focus of Cover the Uninsured Week, which is underway. Philip Wong with the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and the Human Services Coalition of Oregon says a lack of health insurance leads to poor health care because people don't get things like cancer screenings.
So what you lose out a lot is some of the preventative health care. And without preventative health care, you do set yourself up for much costlier medical care in the future.
Nearly 50% of the uninsured adults in Oregon say they can't afford to go to the doctor when they're sick. And that's the second highest rate in the nation.
If you have a medical need right now that needs treatment, you're not going to worry about the future because if you don't take care of your health care needs now, you may not have a future.
Wong says the lack of health insurance was highlighted by the recently passed payday loan reform bill. Surveys show that about 20% of the high-interest loans were used to pay for medical bills. For more information on the issue and the report, call Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon at 503-221-1054. That's 503-221-1054. The report with the insurance statistics for Oregon and the nation is at rwjf.org. I'm Sheila Whiteside, KBU News.
Recently, Governor Ted Kulongoski praised the citizens and businesses of Corvallis for their use of clean, renewable energy and for winning designation by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency as the West Coast's first green power community. In a celebration at the Corvallis-Benton County Library, the governor joined other local, state, and federal leaders in congratulating the community for its collaborative effort to buy and utilize renewable energy through Pacific Power's Blue Sky program and a similar program through Consumers Power. One of the governor's high priorities in the next session of the legislature, he said, is a bill to establish a renewable energy portfolio standard, putting Oregon on a path to derive 25% of its total energy from renewable energy sources by the year 2025. Corvallis ranks first among Oregon cities in the percentage of customers who buy renewable energy through optional renewable energy programs. Thus far, more than 2,800 Corvallis households and 93 businesses have enrolled in such programs. The city itself purchases 75,000 kilowatt hours of Blue Sky wind energy every month.
Congressman Peter DeFazio earned a 92% rating from the Peace Action Education Fund for his congressional voting record from the 2005 session of the 109th Congress. The median score for all members of Congress was 33%. PAEF, a sister organization to Peace Action, based the lawmakers' grades on their votes on issues such as the war in Iraq, torture, the policy of preemptive military attack, military recruitment practices, nuclear weapons policy, weapons in space, and funding for the United Nations. DeFazio said in response that his goal has been to transition federal budget priorities from lavish weapons spending and military interventions to increased investment in education, Social Security, health care, and other pressing needs.
A benefit is planned in St. John's this Saturday for a Portland program that helps teens cope with parenthood. The Board of Insight's Teen Parent Program is hosting a free fundraising lunch, which includes a baby fashion show. KBU's Stephanie Potter has more.
The Insights Teen Parent Program is a 27-year-old nonprofit, which is the primary provider of services for pregnant and parenting teens in Multnomah County. According to Belle Bennett, director of the program,
there are 13 programs, and annually they serve about 1,500 families.
The services and support are free and include homeless, child abuse, and back-to-school programs. Bennett emphasized that the services are strength-based and respect-based.
That means that we don't put our goals on young parents. We ask them what they want and what they think they need, and we work from there. And then maybe, you know, we'll encourage them to do some of the things that we would like to see them do. But once the trusting relationship is built and we work with what they need, then they're more likely to want to move forward and maybe go to school and finish school or get a job. They'll understand more once their basic needs are met what they need to do for their family.
Although the U.S. still has the highest teen pregnancy and birth rates in the Western industrialized world, these rates have declined steadily from 1991 to 2004, with an overall decline of 33% for those aged 15 to 19.
The rate has dropped. The highest teen pregnancy rate right now is among Hispanic and Latino teens.
Bennett said that the rate for that population continues to grow.
And so that's definitely a group of teens that we work with. We have several case managers who are bilingual in Spanish.
She mentioned that almost half of the clients served by the program report having been physically abused as children, and 80% were sexually abused.
But, you know, most of them say they don't want to pass that on to their children, that they want to stop the cycle of abuse in their family. So they're pretty open to, you know, receiving information about this and to learning new things.
She also mentioned that working there has changed some of her own impressions of teen parents.
I think it's important to know that teen parents aren't necessarily who you think they are. A lot of people make judgments about young parents. I've only been doing this for 2 years, and, you know, I came in with some judgments about who teen moms and dads are, and they've kind of all been, you know, debunked. So it's kind of cool that I've learned that they're just like every other parent except they're younger. They really, almost all of them have the desire to do something better for their kids than how they were parented.
The budget is about $1.3 million this year, and funding is a serious issue for the program. With the Bush administration, there have been major cutbacks.
It's decreased because of the loss of federal funding. I think we lost about $500,000 a year.
Bennett is hoping for a large turnout this Saturday at a free lunch fundraiser in St. John's. Titled Open Your Heart for Young Families, the luncheon will offer a baby fashion show and raffle.
A young mom will be speaking along with one of our case managers who serves some of our most vulnerable clients, including those who've survived child abuse and domestic violence.
That was Belle Bennett of the Insights Teen Parent Program. The lunch is this Saturday, May 6th, from 12 to 1:30 at the Center for Family Success at 8010 North Charleston in St. John's. You can call Belle Bennett at Insights to RSVP, or for more information about Insights and their programs. That number is 503-239-6996, extension 223. Again, 503-239-6996, extension 223. I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
A new landfill has been prepared at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation to store radioactive waste that is being turned into glass. The first 42-foot hole is ready at the Integrated Disposal Facility, which could eventually expand to 26 acres. It has a 7-foot thick liner and monitors to detect radioactive leaks. It was built for $25 million by the contractor CH2M Hill.
A federal judge in Portland is hearing arguments today over dams and salmon in the Columbia Basin. The case concerns operation of federal irrigation projects in southern Idaho. Conservation groups and commercial salmon fishermen want U.S. District Judge James Redden to combine the federal plan for protecting salmon from dams in the Upper Snake Basin with a similar plan for the Lower Snake and Columbia Rivers. Judge Redden has already declared that the plan for the Lower Snake and Columbia violates the Endangered Species Act. Michael Garrity of American Rivers says that they hope that by combining the two plans, it will become clear that it is necessary to breach four dams on the Lower Snake to help salmon.
A play geared towards students attending elementary schools in Marion County is teaching them the importance of conserving and recycling. The play is called Alice in Blunderland. It features a cast of Salem-Keizer District Utility Conservation Specialist Kat Hill, AmeriCorps volunteer Heidi Leitke, and Deborah Topp, City of Salem Public Works Specialist. Hill says the play is fun, educational, and effective. She says that students and staff regularly turn off unused electric equipment, and it helped the Salem-Keizer School District avoid nearly $1 million in energy costs over the last 2 years. Thanks to a grant from the City of Salem Watershed Protection Program, Alice in Blunderland will be filmed and made available on video to schools later this month.
And now, time for another edition of KBOO's homegrown weekly environmental series, Our Backyard, produced and hosted by our friend Edison Carter.
Welcome to Our Backyard, locally produced reports and commentary about issues affecting food, water, and air quality in our backyard. This edition, President Bush's nominee to head the Department of Interior again demonstrates the current administration's continued contempt for the environment and what all this means to our backyard. The Natural Resources Defense Council issued a statement on the resignation last month of Secretary of Interior Gail Norton, stating, Gail Norton is responsible for the destruction of public wildlands and key wildlife habitat. Her goal was to give away as many of our publicly owned resources as she could to the energy, timber, and mining industries, and by that measure, she was very successful. But the Interior Department's job also is to protect our land, protect our drinking water sources, and protect the wildlife that makes that land home. She never took that part of her responsibility seriously. Ms. Norton said she now is setting her sights on the public sector. Unfortunately, her record suggests she has been working for private special interests all along. President Bush's nominee to succeed Ms. Norton, Idaho Governor Dirk Kempthorne, amassed a dismal environmental record during his 6 years in the U.S. Senate in the 1990s, scoring a zero on the League of Conservation Voters legislative scoreboards for every year except 1993, when he scored a 6% rating on the basis of one minor vote. As a senator, Kempthorne championed legislation to significantly weaken the Endangered Species Act that would have required a cost-benefit analysis to determine whether a species should be listed as endangered or not, and it allowed government agencies to exempt their own activities from Endangered Species Act protections and waived a requirement that gives citizens the opportunity to comment during development and approval of habitat conservation plans. This legislation was gleefully supported by the American Forest and Paper Association, the American Petroleum Institute, the National Mining Association, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, and the National Association of Realtors, as well as neoclassical environmental economists who want, as John Bellamy Foster, author of the excellent book Ecology Against Capitalism, so clearly put it, to break the environment down into specific goods and services, separated out from the biosphere, and even from particular ecosystems, in such a way as to make them into commodities. In 1998, Kempthorne became governor of Idaho. During his first 4.5 years in office, the state's air got dirtier, more rivers were polluted, fewer polluters were inspected, and toxic emissions increased, according to analysis of Idaho pollution data from the Environmental Protection Agency and state records. According to Chuck Clusen, a Natural Resources Defense Council senior policy analyst, President Bush could not have made a more anti-environmental choice for his new Secretary of the Interior. Dirk Kempthorne surely will continue this administration's drill first, ask questions later approach to public land stewardship. And he adds that his abysmal environmental record as a senator and a governor speaks for itself. Dirk Kempthorne is Gail Norton in pants. Okay, so what does that mean to us? What's the threat to our backyard? Well, the Department of Interior is charged with managing federal land in the 13 western states. That's nearly 93% of all federal land in the nation. And federal land in Oregon is 52.4%. Each of us has an enormous stake in how these public lands in Oregon are managed. The disappointment of environmental organizations and activists throughout the western states over Kempthorne's nomination has been consistent. The Montana Missoulian summed it up nicely in an editorial. We don't want public lands ruined or handed off to somebody's crony. Wouldn't it be nice if, for a change, the president put the Department of Interior into the hands of someone more adept at creating consensus than controversy? Give us a steward of these public assets who'll share our respect for the common ground, not one who'll maintain the public land legacy as a battleground. The Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources will hold confirmation hearings this week on Dirk Kempthorne's nomination, and it will be an opportunity to review and address the defective public land management policies adopted and implemented by the Bush administration during the past 5 years. As it turns out, both of Oregon's senators sit on this important committee. So let Senator Wyden and Senator Smith know how you feel about this nomination by emailing, or even more effectively, by calling their offices. In the meantime, keep listening to KBOO News and Public Affairs and stay informed. After all, this is our backyard.
5:20. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee has vowed to hold hearings regarding presidential power next month. The humanitarian crisis in Darfur has pushed Sudan to the top of the global index of failed states. And hear the story of a man who has lived 50 years in a treehouse to distance himself from his wife. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
Investigative reporter Jason Leopold with TruthOut.com is hot on the trail of Karl Rove's indictment on charges that he helped leak Valerie Plame's identity as a CIA operative. This week, Jason spoke with KBOO's Lisa Loving about Rove, Watergate, and the irony of Washington Post investigative reporter Bob Woodward's involvement with both. This is part one.
So what's happening right now is that the charges have been written up in terms of what he will be charged with, which is perjury and lying to investigators. Now, of course, I should say that when you're dealing with a high-profile legal case, whether it's a murder case or anything that involves anything that's either white-collar crime or a violent type of case, anything could happen at the last minute. Meaning that Karl Rove could very well agree to a plea deal. Testify against other individuals, or at least point fingers at other people who may have been involved. So, we really won't know whether he's indicted until the grand jury actually votes. But as it stands at this point right now, he has not accepted any plea deal. He has not been offered any plea deal, and it appears that he is going to be indicted for, at the very least, perjury and lying to investigators. And the one thing that's still hanging out there is obstruction of justice. And the reason for that is that he did not disclose an email, and he actually tried to cover up the fact that he had there was an email in existence showing that he had this communication with this reporter from Time Magazine.
Okay, many of us here in Portland, Oregon, from where we sit, we're just putting this up next to Watergate because we just assume that impeaching the president would be the big golden egg on this, although there's other people standing back and saying, yeah, but look at who's standing behind President Bush to be president. Maybe we shouldn't so rush to pick him off. But anyway, how does this whole situation, if we were going to make it a timeline, how does this compare with Watergate? Is the Bush administration on target to have the same experience?
Well, it should have. In my opinion, it's just as serious as Watergate. It's just as scandalous as Watergate. And the difference between this scandal and Watergate is that we actually have a war going on. This involves war, and this involves lives that are lost. Soldiers that were killed, American soldiers that were killed, who went to war on based on a lie. And that's what makes this much more serious. But like Watergate, this is a cover-up. The cover-up is worse than the crime. And it appears that we actually have much more evidence. There's so much more evidence available to show how the Bush administration was involved in trying to silence a critic of the Iraq War, which is the CIA agent's husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, and how doing so, led to the leak of his wife. And it just shows that there are so many people who had their hands in the pot here, who are very involved in this campaign to discredit and silence this critic because they did not want it to impede upon their upon their plans. So the reason that we don't see this being treated as seriously as Watergate is because of the media. Having worked in very mainstream publications like the Los Angeles Times, I've worked for a division of the Wall Street Journal, Dow Jones Newswires, we have come to a point where we just don't attack a story like this and do some really hard-hitting investigative reporting, which is what a story like this requires. And that's the difference between Watergate and this. And it doesn't help when you have one of the key figures in Watergate, Bob Woodward, downplaying the importance of this.
That was truthout.org investigative reporter Jason Leopold. Tune in tomorrow for part two.
The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, accusing the White House of a very blatant encroachment on congressional authority, said yesterday that he will hold an oversight hearing into President Bush's assertion that he has the power to bypass more than 750 laws enacted over the past 5 years. Arlen Specter said he plans to hold the hearings in June. He said he intends to call administration officials to explain and defend the president's claims of authority, as well as to invite constitutional scholars to testify on whether Bush has overstepped the boundaries of his power. Specter's announcement followed a report in the Sunday Globe that Bush has quietly asserted the authority to ignore provisions in 750 bills that he has signed, about 1 in 10. Over the past 5 years, Bush has stated that he can defy any statute that conflicts with his interpretation of the Constitution. In many instances, Bush cited his role as head of the executive branch or as commander-in-chief to justify the exemptions. The statutes that Bush has asserted the right to override include numerous rules and regulations for the military, job protection for whistleblowers who tell Congress about possible government wrongdoing, affirmative action requirements, and safeguards against political interference in federally funded research.
Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said yesterday that a Republican proposal in Congress to set up a watchdog over the federal courts is, quote, a really scary idea. Ginsburg told a gathering of the American Bar Association that lawyers should stick up for judges when they are criticized by congressional leaders. As an example, she mentioned proposals by senior Republicans who want an inspector general to police judges' acceptances of free trips or for their possible financial interests with groups that could appear before them. Senator Charles Grassley, an Iowa Republican, said last week that the judiciary wasn't doing enough policing of itself. His plan would create an inspector general to oversee federal courts, including the Supreme Court. The inspector general would be directed to report any judicial misconduct to the Justice Department. House Judiciary Committee Chairman James Sensenbrenner has proposed a separate plan to cover lower federal courts only. Ginsburg said her concerns were about the legislative branch setting up a so-called guardian for the judicial branch. She also said there have been discussions in Congress about limiting the scope of courts.
A federal jury rejected the death penalty for al-Qaeda conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui on Wednesday and decided that he must spend his life in prison for his role in the deadliest terrorist attack in U.S. history. After 7 days of deliberation, the 9 men and 3 women rebuffed the government's appeal for death for the only person charged in this country in the 4 suicide jetliner hijackings that killed nearly 3,000 people on September 11, 2001.
The Senate is poised to pass a $107 billion emergency supplemental request. The majority of funding will go toward the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, while a lesser amount will go toward the Gulf Coast region. In addition, billions will also fund pet projects that fiscal conservatives say do not belong in an emergency spending bill. And some critics say there should not be an emergency supplemental at all. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
A $500 million compensation package to defense contractor Northrop Grumman for business lost during Hurricane Katrina is just one amendment that has been added to the Senate's emergency spending package. Mississippi Senators Trent Lott and Thad Cochran, who is also the head of the Appropriations Committee, pushed this amendment. That is just one of many that fiscal conservative Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma tried to strip from the large emergency supplemental.
It's like Senator Lott says. He and Senator Cochran are a wily couple of guys, and they are. And they can twist a lot of arms. There's a lot of favors. There's a lot of trade. There's a lot of things you're not going to get if you vote against the chairman of the Appropriation Committee. So that power is still very powerful. We have to neutralize that to get the authorizing power just as powerful as appropriators.
Senator Coburn also tried to strip $75 million for agriculture assistance, $6 million for Hawaii sugarcane growers, $230 million for military aircraft, $200 million to replace damaged fishing gear, and an additional $2 billion for levee rebuilding. He says they are all pet projects, gifts to voters this election year, and beyond what the president asked. Republican Senator Jim Bunning from Kentucky says he will vote against the supplemental.
I believe we need to cut spending and work out a responsible plan that meets the needs of the war on terror and rebuilding in the Gulf Coast region.
The final cost of the bill will total $107 billion. The president said he would veto any version that surpassed $92 billion. But some critics lay blame on the president, not the Congress. Adam Hughes is director of federal fiscal policy at OMB Watch, a fiscal watchdog group.
The Bush administration is using some kind of technical runarounds in the budgeting process to be able to not have this funding impact things like the deficit and how well the economy is doing and those sorts of things.
This is the fourth emergency request in the past 3 years for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
The emergency requests are approved under expedited procedures. There's no hearings. There's no testimony about whether this is the right amount of funding, whether this is being distributed in the right way. And that's lack of transparency and oversight.
Per the president's request, $67 billion will go toward the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It will fund military personnel, procurement, and equipment. $27 billion will fund Hurricane Katrina recovery, which will include FEMA's disaster fund, community block grant money, levee repairs, and other recovery needs. Another $15 billion will go toward the war on terror and other programs deemed an emergency, including avian flu funding and $100 million for democracy-spreading programs in Iran. Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan from North Dakota agrees that the war should not be funded through a supplemental.
Well, the supplementals reflect bad budgeting. I mean, you know, the administration's budget should have included requests for funding for Iraq and Afghanistan. Katrina's a different issue. No one could have predicted Katrina. But these giant supplementals just reflect budget games and bad budgeting, you know, not asking for funds they should ask for in the regular budget process.
Senator Dorgan says he will vote for the funding to support the troops. Also included in the supplementals, a $2 billion offset for border security at the U.S.-Mexico border. Senator Frist hopes this will please Republicans who oppose citizenship of undocumented immigrants and want strict border security in the immigration debate. Republican Senator John Cornyn from Texas.
I think that's a down payment. It's awfully expensive, but the problem is the federal government's neglected its responsibilities along the border for too long. But I am pleased with the progress we're making.
Senator Cornyn is attempting to include a provision in the emergency funding that will do away with the so-called catch-and-release program of undocumented immigrants. If it's not accepted in this emergency bill, he will bring it up at a later date. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne.
As state and local officials on the Gulf Coast scramble to help panicked residents flee Hurricane Katrina on August 29th of last year, mobile communications units developed by the Federal Emergency Management Agency were at Barksdale Air Force Base in Shreveport, Louisiana, outside the disaster area, and did not make it to the state's Emergency Operations Center in Baton Rouge until the day after the storm hit. In addition, according to a bipartisan Senate committee report released yesterday, most of the U.S. Forest Service's 5,000 radios, the largest civilian cache in the United States, remained unused. In the 8 months since Katrina devastated Louisiana and Mississippi, much has been written about how the failure of communications hampered relief and rescue efforts. Several reports, including one by a House Select Committee that Democratic leaders boycotted, and another conducted by the White House, documented a collapse of telephones, computers, and radio networks. The 750-page Hurricane Katrina, A Nation Still Unprepared, issued by the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee after 22 hearings over 7 months, added some gripping details to the familiar narrative. The panel's main recommendations, which included a call for FEMA to be dismantled and restructured, were announced last week.
The Minuteman Project Civilian Border Patrol Group has begun a cross-country caravan tour that will end on Capitol Hill to garner support for its Get Tough Border stance and to pressure federal lawmakers in considering immigration reform. Organizers hope the trip will help counter marches staged Monday around the nation by more than 1 million people demanding fair treatment of illegal immigrants. They also intend to mobilize voters and recruit members along the way.
What's left of unity in the Episcopal Church is at stake, heading into a weekend election for the Bishop of California that sets up a major clash over the role of gays in the church. Three of the seven candidates are openly gay, and choosing one of them to head the Diocese of California would further alienate Episcopal conservatives already feeling betrayed that the church approved a gay bishop 3 years ago. It could also fracture the stained relationship between America's 2.3 million Episcopalians and their parent body, the Worldwide Anglican Communion.
Two environmental groups are trying to get a San Francisco judge to order the nation's biggest school bus operator to post warnings about diesel fumes coming from its buses. In a complaint filed yesterday in San Francisco County Superior Court, the Environmental Law Foundation and Our Children's Earth Foundation are asking a judge to force Laidlaw Transit to put written warnings on buses about the dangers of diesel fumes. The groups say the fumes expose children to chemicals known to cause neurological, respiratory, and cardiovascular disease.
In a race painted as political insider versus outsider for Ohio's scandal-tainted Republican Party, Bible-toting outsider Kenneth Blackwell won the GOP nomination for governor. The Ohio primary was closely watched as a barometer of voter dissatisfaction amid the state and national Republican scandals that led to ethics charges against the governor and have tied U.S. Representative Bob Ney to Washington lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Ney won his first opposed primary this decade against an unfunded opponent yesterday. In November, Blackwell will face Democratic U.S. Representative Ted Strickland, who easily defeated former State Representative Brian Flannery yesterday. Blackwell, whose prominence as a leading African-American voice in the GOP could be pivotal, portrayed himself in the run-up to the primary as the best candidate to deliver the state Republican Party from a year of scandals and infighting. Blackwell gained attention as the Republican chief of state... Republican chief state elections official in 2004, when the state returned President Bush to the White House. Blackwell also served in the Reagan administration and is known for carrying a Bible with him everywhere. Compared with his Democratic opponent, Blackwell is a free marketeer. Strickland supports a higher minimum wage and favors abortion rights, while Blackwell opposes them.
The Bush administration says local governments and business leaders should not count on the federal government alone to rescue them in the event of a bird flu pandemic. In a letter announcing an updated bird flu plan, President Bush says the U.S. will face this global threat as a united front. But Bush also writes that individual citizens are necessary to the success of minimizing what could be massive social and economic disruptions. Today's report predicts a severe outbreak could take up to 40% of the workforce off the job for a few weeks at a time.
Last year, with a veritable gusher of oil profits flooding into the coffers of ExxonMobil, CEO Lee Raymond moaned that he really didn't know what to do with so much money. But now we learn that he quickly figured out what to do with a big pool of it. He gave it to himself. Lee retired at the end of last year, and he cashed out bigger than any bank robber in history. He walked away with a package of cash and stock payments worth about $42 million. Then he took a lump sum pension benefit worth another $98 million. Not bad for a guy who pushed to reduce pension benefits for ExxonMobil's blue-collar workers. But wait, that's barely the half of it. Brother Raymond also sacked up stock and other compensation worth an extra $258 million. This brings his total payout to nearly $400 million. Let's see. He was CEO for 12 years. So that works out to a farewell package of some $33 million for each of his years. Sure, ExxonMobil has done well, especially in the last couple of years, but this is due to an astronomical run-up in oil and gasoline prices, having nothing to do with any managerial genius on the part of Lee. But he is a genius in negotiating sweet deals for himself. In addition to salting away a gold mine for his golden years, Raymond also got Exxon to pick up his country club fees while in retirement. Plus, he'll get to use the corporate jet, get money to pay for tax advisors, and be paid an extra $1 million to serve as a consultant to ExxonMobil this year. He'll also get a free security system for his home, be assigned security guards, and be given a limousine and driver. This is Jim Hightower saying, all of this will be deducted from ExxonMobil's corporate income tax as a business expense, meaning you and I get to subsidize Lee's retirement. Come on, Lee, couldn't you at least cover your own country club fees? Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for Independent Native News following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. here, Circle A Radio. At 7, it's nonstop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Tonight's weather is clear, lows around 40.
Tomorrow is sunny, highs 75 to 80. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The humanitarian crisis in Darfur, which is now spilling over into neighboring Chad, has pushed Sudan to the top of the global index of failed states, a report compiled by the American magazine Foreign Policy and the think tank Fund for Peace. African nations made up 6 of the 10 failed states in the study, and the regional impact of the Darfur crisis was reflected in Chad's presence at number 6. The failed states index ranked nations by giving them a score based on criteria such as the massive movement of refugees and internally displaced peoples, widespread violation of human rights, and intervention of other states. The 3-year internal conflict in Darfur has led to the deaths of more than 180,000 people and the displacement of more than 2 million. The scale of the crisis puts Sudan ahead of the Democratic Republic of Congo and the previous poll topper Somalia, as well as Iraq. The Darfur peace talks, taking place in the Nigerian capital Abuja, have dragged on for 2 years, with mediators expressing frustration at the warring parties' unwillingness to compromise or to respect a ceasefire. The top 10 failed states in order are the Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ivory Coast, Iraq, Zimbabwe, Chad, Somalia, Haiti, Pakistan, and Afghanistan.
The year 2005 will remain the deadliest in 10 years for journalists, the account published today by Reporters Without Borders. According to that organization, 63 journalists and 5 media collaborators were killed in 2005. They also count 1,300 aggressions or threats to which reporters around the world were victim. RSF also deems that, quote, close to a third of the world's population lives in a country where freedom of the press does not exist. Since the beginning of the war in Iraq in March 2003, 88 media professionals have been killed there, including 24 in 2005. 12 reporters or guides have been killed since the beginning of this year, like Kasai Kadban, an Iraqi journalist killed April 22nd. 3 are presently being held hostage. The Near East remains the most dangerous part of the world for journalists, according to RSF.
A study by the United Nations Children's Fund has revealed that almost one-third of children in southern and eastern Africa are undernourished and that little progress is being made on addressing the problem. UNICEF says the situation in many countries is actually deteriorating. In this, its fourth report card on nutrition, UNICEF says nearly one-third of all children under the age of 5 in eastern and southern Africa are dangerously underweight and are losing out on essential nutrition. The report blames the situation on poverty, conflict, drought, and food crises in the region and points to the HIV/AIDS pandemic as a major contributing factor. The report, called Progress for Children, says only one country in the region, Botswana, is on track to achieve the first Millennium Development Goal of eradicating extreme poverty and hunger by 2015. The report says mineral and vitamin supplements are essential to addressing the problem in some of the poorest communities. Iodine deficiencies are being controlled in 7 countries through the compulsory sale of iodized salt. UNICEF will continue to lobby governments, NGOs, and the private sector to implement new food supplement programs.
Renewed sectarian violence in the western Indian state of Gujarat has left 6 people dead and tensions continue to smolder. FSRN correspondent Binu Alex has more.
Early this morning, a Hindu mob of around 1,500 people torched a Muslim youth inside his car, and retaliatory attacks may escalate violence in Vadodara as military is being called in. Rights groups say the current violence is a reaction to open wounds that have not yet been healed. The latest violence began on May 1 when police opened fire at what they described as a violent crowd of Muslims protesting against the demolition of a shrine. 5 of the Muslim demonstrators were killed. The civic body which demolished the shrine claimed it was merely following an order from the state's high court to remove illegal encroachments on roads. Muslims, however, insist the shrine was a 200-year-old monument and not an encroachment. Gradually, the violence that erupted thereafter ran out of control, with the right-wing pro-Hindu BJP party, which rules Gujarat, unable to contain it even after 4 days. The Hindus also came out to protest, and clashes between the two communities began thereafter. Even the funeral processions of the two killed by the police fire was also interrupted by violent protests. The BJP and its Chief Minister Narendra Modi have been accused of tacitly supporting the violence against religious minorities, namely Muslims and Christians. However, he played down the current situation.
As you can see, the situation is under control, and after the violence yesterday, nothing serious has occurred. But despite that, as a precaution, I've requested for an army flag march through the city.
Not taking any chances, the federal government decided to deploy the army directly. The move is seen as a precautionary measure against a repeat of 2002 Gujarat violence, which resulted in the deaths of 254 Hindus and 790 Muslims, according to an Indian central government report released last year. Human rights groups put the number of deaths somewhat between 2,000 and 3,500. V.K. Duggal is the secretary in Federal Government Interior Ministry.
Although the situation is under control, but still the tension levels are quite high. And I have spoken to the Chief Secretary Gujarat, and they are already in touch with the army authorities. We hope the state government will be able to bring the situation under control quickly and normalize it as soon as possible.
Rights groups claim most Muslims see police and government agencies as part of Hindu communal organizations here. The killings of the protesters only added fuel to the fire. They claim the undercurrents are high and the two communities still have to reconcile following the violence 4 years ago. This has been Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
In Chile's southern city of Temuco, four jailed Mapuche Indians have hardened their more than 50-day hunger strike by refusing to take any fluids at all. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garitón has the story.
The four were sentenced to 10 years in jail and ordered to pay a fine of nearly $900,000 for setting fires to property belonging to Chilean forestry giant Mininco in 2001. The Mapuches were tried under Chile's tough anti-terrorism act for the forest fires set in lands the Mapuches claim as their own. The trial that convicted the four last year was a second trial after a Supreme Court decision ordered a retrial after ruling that the first trial had fundamental errors. In the second trial, the prosecution introduced hooded witnesses who testified that the four were responsible for the arson campaign. The Mapuche region of southern Chile has many land disputes. Communities say their lands were confiscated during the military dictatorship and given to the forestry industry. Chile is one of the largest world producers of wood products, pulp, and paper. During a May Day demonstration in Santiago, groups supporting the Mapuches fought riot police amidst a growing movement of mostly university students demanding the release of the Mapuches. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
The United Nations International Labour Organization says that 1.3 million Latin Americans are being subject to forced labour. The ILO has called for special programs for rural areas, national awareness-raising campaigns, and stronger labour inspection systems. The report recommends that countries with strong indigenous populations, such as Bolivia, Guatemala, and Peru, should be priority targets. Brazil had taken the lead in fighting the problem, having freed 18,000 workers in the last decade from harsh working and living conditions.
An Armenian plane has crashed into the Black Sea off the Russian coast, killing all 113 people aboard. The Airbus A320 went down shortly before it was due to land in the Russian city of Sochi. It was initially refused permission to land because of the poor weather conditions there. The search for passengers' body has been hampered by weather conditions, and only 25 have so far been recovered from the water. Owners of the airline, Armavia, said it was in good condition and that the crew was experienced.
Puerto Rico is in its second day of a partial government shutdown, leaving nearly 100,000 public sector workers without income. The government declared a shutdown yesterday after the governor and the opposition-controlled legislature failed to solve a stalemate over a budget shortfall of nearly $750 million. Puerto Rico's government is the island's largest employer, with around 200,000 workers. Many restaurants and other small businesses also depend indirectly on the public sector.
More than 1,000 families living in a shanty town near the Cambodian capital of Phnom Penh are being evicted from their homes to make way for a new shopping center. The relocation of families away from their homes next to the Pasak River is the latest in a series of forced evictions. A local businessman claims to be the rightful owner of the land they live on. The families are being moved to a site more than 12 miles away without sewage services, water, or electricity. Many residents also say that they will not be able to afford to travel to work if they are moved further away from the city.
An important wind circulation pattern over the Pacific Ocean had begun to weaken because of global warming caused by human activity. It's not clear what climate changes might arise in the area or possibly beyond, but the long-term effect might resemble some aspects of an El Niño event. El Niños boost rainfall in the southern United States and western South America and bring dry weather or even drought to Indonesia, Malaysia, and elsewhere in the western Pacific.
A man in India's eastern state of Orissa has been living in a tree for the past 50 years following a quarrel with his wife. Gayahar Parida, who lives in a tree in a village 240 kilometers north of the state capital, has repeatedly turned down pleas by his wife and children to return home, a report said yesterday. Parida's wife said, "We quarreled over a tiny issue, and that is why he left me and promised not to live with me or return home until his death. I've tried a lot and forced him to come back, but he has refused all the time." Parida's strange abode is a makeshift shed on a tree located about a quarter mile from his actual house. For many years, Parida lived in a mango tree but was forced to move to his new address after the tree collapsed in a storm. Parida said the unusual lifestyle has helped him in his spiritual growth and in overcoming tensions after the estrangement with his wife. Parida's only son, Babula, said his dad was adamant in his decision, adding, "I have tried several times to woo him back home, but he's refused to return. Hurt and dejected, I had to come back home. I cried a lot, but in vain." Parida isn't the only tree man in Orissa. Earlier this year, the BBC told of a 45-year-old man who, perhaps influenced by Parida, had been living in a tree for 15 years following a tiff with his wife.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 3rd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on Translator K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM, on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Our assistant producer is Jasonia Watson. Tonight's audio editors are Lisa Loving. Special thanks to reporters Spencer Raymond, Lisa Loving, Edison Carter, Sheila Whiteside, and Stephanie Potter. Our engineer is Joshua Johnson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30 on Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, Joanne and Dave speak with Chris Carey, founder and executive director of the Daywalker Foundation, which educates the public on the importance of building effective anti-trafficking laws in the U.S. At 9, Marlies Franklin interviews longtime human rights activist David Oakes of Mind Freedom International, a coalition working for the rights of people diagnosed with psychiatric disabilities. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell will be on vacation. Instead of Press Watch, we'll have a special election season program featuring the candidates for the Democratic side in the race for Oregon State Representative District 46, which covers parts of northeast and southeast Portland, including the neighborhoods of Laurelhurst, Mount Tabor, South Tabor, Center, Montevilla, Woodland Park, and parts of Powellhurst, Gilbert, and Hazelwood. At 10:10, hear an interview with documentary filmmaker Fawn Keem. Her new film, The Tomato Effect, explores her father's death 10 years ago. He led a controversial life as a physician practicing environmental medicine. At 10:30 on Art Focus, host Julie Bernard speaks with Portland painter and teacher Lucinda Parker about her current show at the Laura Russo Gallery and much more. And at 11 is Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us, and have a great evening.
This is Independent Native News for Wednesday, the 3rd of May. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Idaho and Washington tribes are wrestling with their respective states over who gets the tax paid on gasoline purchased on tribal reservations. Correspondent Elizabeth Wynn Johnson reports.
Currently, Idaho tribes charge their own tax on gasoline, and they match what the state charges off-reservation. Some lawmakers recently tried to impose a solution that would have given all that tax money to the state. Lieutenant Governor Risch says he'd rather see the state negotiate than litigate, but he vented his frustration when the meeting failed to produce any concrete agreements. But spokesman Quanah Spencer of the Coeur d'Alene tribe says he still considers the meeting a success.
Well, I think the governor came in here with a conception that this is a very simplistic issue and that it can get boiled down into a two-hour session and there's an agreement at the end of that session without having a lot of discussion of the issues, which are complicated as they relate to each individual tribe.
The tribes and the state plan to keep talking, though Risch says he probably won't be at the table himself next time. In Washington state, the governor's office and several tribes are also struggling to come to terms with who gets gas tax money. I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson in Coeur d'Alene.
Under the Native American Lands Environmental Mitigation Program, or NALEMP, the Department of Defense collaborates with tribes to clean up military impacts on Native lands. DOD officials and representatives from 32 tribes met in Sitka, Alaska last week for the 10-year anniversary of the program. Melissa Marconi-Wenzel reports.
The Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe, working with the Army Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Navy, recently wrapped up a three-year project to reclaim Pyramid Lake, the largest lake in Nevada, and a significant subsistence and cultural resource for the tribe. Pyramid Lake was the site of military munitions training during World War II. Tons of excess material, or ordnance, was dumped in the lake when the military left. The tribe brought up almost 500 rockets and over 27,000 pounds of small arms ammunition, Tribal Chairman Norman Harry.
You know, we've developed a good relationship with DOD and the Corps of Engineers, and I think that's going to lead a lot further with other issues that the tribe's having to deal with.
NALEMP receives a $10 million appropriation each year. Some tribal leaders are saying NALEMP is not given enough money to meet the needs of Native Americans. Again, Norman Harry.
There are about 500 surveys that have been taken of impacted lands. So I think that just goes to demonstrate, you know, the need for increased funding.
Department of Defense Senior Tribal Liaison Paul Lumley was sympathetic, but he didn't offer any assurances.
Given that we only have $10 million a year, we're trying to find ways to improve the way we implement our program so that we can get the biggest bang for the buck.
Beyond funding, Harry says there were a whole host of issues brought up by tribal representatives at the meeting. But bottom line, he says everyone is working together to make those improvements happen. In Sitka, Alaska, I'm Melissa Marconi-Wenzel.
A private business has partnered with tribal leaders in the Great Plains to improve access to health care by putting air ambulances on reservations. Johanna Saylor has this report on how the partnership can save lives and money.
CEO of PestNet, John Warnock, says it takes an average of 4 hours to pick up a patient on the Rosebud Reservation and fly them to a trauma center in Sioux Falls.
My four-year-old son managed to choke himself on broccoli. I Heimlich'd him, and it took 7 minutes for the paramedics to arrive, perhaps the longest 7 minutes of my life. I can't possibly imagine what it means to hold a child's hand for 4 hours.
Warnock says having an air ambulance always ready on the reservation will cut that time in half. His company, PassNet, plans to station air ambulances on 50 reservations, starting with Rosebud and Pine Ridge this summer. Oglala Sioux Tribal President Cecilia Fire Thunder says having the ambulances will also save the tribe money.
We can bring in the cardiologist, the oncologist, and all of the other specialists to do a one-day clinic to see not just one patient, but maybe 5 or 10 patients.
Insurance coverage from Indian Health Services, Veterans Affairs, Medicaid, and Medicare will pay PassNet for transporting patients. I'm Johanna Saylor in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's E-Edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.